Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
I did an interview the other day. It was a local news interview. I think it was in the Bay Area. Super nice, but it was not like a political show. She immediately went to the 2024 presidential because that's where people's minds go. And so we talked about that and I covered why. And I said, but you know, there are 500,000 races. I was saying a lot of the things we've said on this podcast. And then she said, okay, well, I want to ask you a follow-up question. Some people are saying that they are worried that the Forward Party will take votes from the other two parties. And I would like to know how you'd respond to that. And I said, yes, that's our plan. We are going to do that. We're a political party.
It is my pleasure to welcome to Forward, political strategist, startup guru, advisor to the Forward Party on coalition building, and all-around awesome activist and champion for democracy, Lucy Caldwell. Welcome, Lucy.
Hey, Andrew. It's fun to be with you. How are
you? You kidding? You and I hang out all the time in churches in Chicago, in airports, in conference rooms. So you have a really fascinating path. Thrilled to be working with you to build Forward. This is a very open-ended question, but how the heck did you get here? And one of the things I really want to dig into, and it should have been part of your intro, is you're the campaign manager for Joe Walsh's 2020 anti-Trump presidential campaign. So you and I met in Iowa back in the day.
Yeah. Well, the short answer to your question of how the hell did I get here is my perennial reliable masochism. No. I got here because I got my start working in politics. I came up on the right side of the aisle. I came up in conservative politics. I ran some campaigns. I lobbied in 30 some states. I really was a young, wide-eyed libertarian, and I just found at the time that the Republican Party was the place that was the best home for me and my ideas in the public square. And along the way, I got out of direct politics to start a company called Crowd Scout, which was a data platform for campaigns and issue advocacy groups and nonprofits. And so I was out of direct politics from 2014 to 2019.
You took a 5-year break and somehow got wrapped back in.
I took a 5-year break, but the but is a big but, which is that we had political clients. And we were a nonpartisan company, but I had come from the right and the right was really underserved in technology at the time. So we wound up functionally with a ton of Republican clients. So we had 7 of the 17 Republican presidential candidates in 2016. We had all the committees. And so I was watching from the sidelines, but also watching how the culture was changing within some of those organizations, like my client, the Republican National Committee, and was horrified. But yes, because of the masochism, when we sold that company, I went to some Trump folks that people have heard of, people like Sarah Longwell and Bill Kristol. And I said, how can I help? Can I help you think about your data strategy? And can I help you build this ecosystem? I'm looking for something to do. And a month later, I was in Iowa with Joe Walsh. So there you have it.
Wow. For those of people who aren't familiar with Sarah Longwell, she's a Never Trump Republican who now is leading an awesome org called the Bulwark. And then Bill Kristol is another very prominent Never Trump commentator. So you go to them and say, hey, guys, how can I help? And then they connect you to Joe?
Yes, exactly. I went to drinks with Sarah. We met for drinks in D.C. to catch up. Sarah and I went way back. We'd worked on issues together in sort of conservative policy world years before. And she said to me, have you heard of Joe Walsh? And I said, I think so. The guy, yeah. And she said, well, we think he should run for president. He's going to run for president. And he really needs someone to run his campaign. And could you talk to him? I think you could do it.
All right. Let's get a date on this. Like, when was this?
Really true. I mean, the timeline is insane. This was like probably in the first week of August of 2019. And
that's really late. But I just wanted level set for you. By that time, I'd been on the trail for a year and a half. But continue.
Well, the Never Trumpers were just like flailing, trying to find people to run. And I flew to Illinois, where Joe is from, where he'd been a congressman from Illinois, a couple of days later. And then I went on a very brief vacation with my husband to Tulum, like a 5-day vacation, which was the vacation that was sort of like, I promise I won't be on my phone. You know, this is going to be so romantic. We're going to be in a beautiful casita with a plunge pool, you know, phones off, just wonderful romantic trip. I worked the entire time and we built up a very scrappy campaign apparatus. And by the next weekend, Joe announced on George Stephanopoulos' show in New York. And it was such a scrappy operation at that time. And it really was a scrappy operation forever, but a really scrappy operation at that time, that I was in the green room at ABC with Joe and Joe's wife, and Chris Christie was on the show that day. So Chris Christie was there just like wanting to talk my ear off about, you know, how bad Trump had been to him, that kind of thing. And so Joe is on and about to make this announcement. And I am thinking like, okay, we're going to have to make sure that everything gets turned over, right? Like the website, the payment processor. And so I'm in this green room and all these people are like, this is very exciting. I'd love to talk to you about this. I'd love to give you some advice. And I think that'd be great. But at the same time, I'm just like opening my computer, trying to make sure like, is the website live? Like press it. I'm like updating Joe's Twitter profile. It was a wild, wild ride. It didn't really get less wild, but here we are.
Well, Lucy, I need to put you in touch with my campaign manager, Zach Grauman, because you guys could share war stories.
Yeah, but we never got a bus. So you graduated out of the scrappy, you know, shop in a good way because you had so much success. And we were always on a kamikaze campaign. So I did eventually have a much larger team who could do things like push updates to social platforms. But it was a wild ride.
All right. So first, who were the other candidates who were considering taking on Trump in the Republican Party in 2020? Was there anyone aside from Joe?
Well, there were other candidates who did that. And actually, some of them were involved with Forward. You know, you had former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld.
Bill Weld was in that. Yeah, continue.
He's great. Yeah. You very briefly had former South Carolina Governor and Congressman Mark Sanford.
But he kind of announced and then receded very, very quick, right?
He did.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it was literally 5 days or something, or like 1 week.
Probably longer than that, but small operation. It was a small operation, and I think it was mostly to raise awareness of, you know, an issue that he's passionate about, which was the national debt. But at the time, that seemed a little bit, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Mark Sanford, but seemed a little tone deaf. Just like, well, we're kind of trying to make sure that democracy, which is on fire, doesn't collapse. And the national debt conversation, good to have, but not the conversation that we're looking to have at this moment. But there were a lot of Republicans that I think people thought might get in. Right? People like Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, or Mitt Romney, who needs no introduction. And it's really odd to look back on that. I mean, that was just 3 years ago. But at the time, we had this idea as the first impeachment began, when the revelations from the fateful call the fateful Ukraine call came out and Alex Vindman came out as a whistleblower, we thought, wow, more Republicans are going to get in now, right? Like, this is like going to be a game changer. This is the end. This is going to be the end for Trump. Now the dam is burst. And we actually had this feeling, what should we do as a campaign if another major Republican, like a John Kasich or Mitt Romney, you name it, gets in? Should we try to get organized and coalesce around one candidate? We were trying to make all these considerations, expecting that other people were going to put their hand up and meet the moment. And we still had, you know, the deadlines because you ran for president. There were still months to go for filing deadlines at the time that that happened between then, and people could still get in the race. And people on the Dem side were still getting in the race at that point. And so we had this idea that we were going to suddenly be in a crowded field of patriotic Republicans standing up against Trump. And, you know, we all know how that turned out. No one came. And in fact, they coalesced around Trump in a way that was really weird. And we could even see it in the grassroots folks in places like Iowa. Like, we don't like him. He's not a good guy, but he's our guy. And actually the tone among Republicans on the campaign trail got so much worse in that fall.
Well, I mean, that's profound. And that's something that has very, very, big implications for what we're seeing right now. There are also implications for what might happen in the Democratic Party if for example, Joe Biden runs again as an incumbent, which I expect to happen personally. And then there's some thought that, someone's going to primary him. I personally think no one primaries him, because if you're a Democrat, particularly if Trump's coming up the other side, and you run against Joe, the incumbent, in a Democratic primary, you're going to be seen as aiding Trump. I think that there are really very, very powerful dynamics that keep people from challenging the leader of the party.
Yeah, and in the case of Joe Biden, some of it is ageism. There is some ageism going on in how people talk about whether or not Joe Biden should continue as the leader of the Democratic Party. And that just is the thing that people don't say. But should there be healthy competition in a party at all times? I think so. And is it good to have one president who, albeit is pro-democracy and not a demagogue, not an authoritarian like Trump, to have in Joe Biden a person who has stood up, but maybe does also think that he alone can fix it? Right? Is that healthy? Probably not. But I think it's a multifaceted landscape, to say the least.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. When you say he alone can fix it, he alone can defeat Trump was always his thesis. And I hung out with Joe a fair amount on the trail. People may not, you know, and I know, but if you're out on the trail, you run into each other all the live long day because there are only so many events, union halls, fish fries, cattle calls, like you name it. I mean, you're around each other all the time. And the dynamic of the Republican Party, it's fascinating to hear that you thought at the time, like, this is going to be the dam bursting. You're going to have the Kasichs, the Romneys, the elder statesmen of the party decide to get in. the fact that that didn't happen doesn't surprise me. But were there moments during that time where you thought, okay, the atmosphere is going to change, or was it fairly consistent? Were there moments where Joe was like, okay, we're going to take advantage of this?
Well, before the first impeachment, we were talking very extensively with a lot of groups. We're really focused on Iowa. Joe is from Illinois, state over. He went to college in Iowa. So we thought, great, these are his people. These nice white Iowans. This is Joe Walsh's base. We're going to connect with these people. And we did. And we were having conversations with endorsements that matter in a Republican primary, people to give endorsements like the cattlemen, right? These are important endorsements in Iowa. And so I do think that we were hoping it would change in a different way, and it changed in the worst way. And it culminated on caucus night. And the Republican caucus in Iowa works a little differently than the Democratic caucus, which is that in the Republican caucus, you still have people coming in and they come up and they talk, but then it is a secret ballot, which I hoped would be helpful in a year like that also, because you can show up wherever. Who's going to show up to a Republican caucus in a year where on the Democratic side, if you're a nice moderate voter, which is like a nice person who doesn't feel tribal, then in, the year 2020, when you have so many really great candidates and exciting candidates and people who have a positive vision of the future, why would you go to the Republican caucus? So there were some structural problems.
What was the turnout of the Republican caucus? So one of the things I tell people, and most people don't realize this, is that something like 6.4% of Iowans participated in the Democratic caucus. It's a very, very low percentage. Do you know what that percentage was on your side?
I don't know the percentage offhand right now at this moment. I knew at one time, but much, much lower. And so I went, you divide your team up and you try to send your candidate to the biggest caucus site. So like Joe went to Ames, and then you send your best surrogates to the next caucus sites. And so I was
I went to a caucus site and had the unhappy experience of getting blown out in that caucus site while I was standing there, and people were before the voting started.
Joe and Bill Weld were at a caucus site where Laura Trump was there, and all of the Trump people that night made the same speech, of course. And Trump didn't go to a caucus site, which is really notable. So they all delivered a speech to each caucus site. And of course, he couldn't have been at all of them, but he could have come to Iowa. Trump barely ever went to Iowa. But they all delivered these speeches, like the president wishes he could be here, and we're all going to keep America great, because people forget that the second campaign, the slogan was actually CAG, Keep America Great. So Joe got up, and Joe is like a fire and brimstone kind of guy. I mean, this is like a former Tea Party congressman who himself was once a Trump supporter. And he got up and he said, I just want you to have, Donald Trump lies to people. He's not honest. And I want you to have a president who tells you the truth. And people booed Joe out. I mean, getting up physically, approaching him, it was like a mob scene. And Joe has told me that was really the first time that he felt physically truly unsafe. And my husband was with Joe that night, because very scrappy campaign. I realized that I had sent Joe's, the person who had been staffing Joe, I had sent that person to another caucus site. Like, I just needed to spread people out. So I said to my husband, who'd come in for that week, I'm like, you've got to go with Joe. And Joe and my husband are forever bonded because of the fear and sense of lack of just physical safety in that room. I was a few miles away at a caucus site where the person who had come to show up on Trump's behalf was Brad Parscale. And Brad Parscale was there in a dark suit, looking quite ominous, with a large team. And as Brad was giving his pitch to the people sitting in this gymnasium of middle school, the Trump team flanked out, sort of fanned out around Brad and walked down the aisle of this middle school gym cafeteria place, whatever, and started placing Keep America Great red caps on the children in the room. So people will bring their kids to a caucus site to see, you're seeing democracy in action at school. Just not This is going to make me sound like I'm really, really like a snowflake, but didn't ask the parents permission. Just, it was this show of force. Like, we are putting these caps on your kids. Right. And I thought, this is a cult.
Well, that does seem kind of indoctrination-y, you know, like, yes. we're going to christen them in a particular way. So you guys announce in August, the caucus is in February. That gives you about 6 months of campaigning. What proportion of the time did you spend in Iowa? And I want to share that I was all over the place, but I came and went to Iowa. I think I counted. It was like 24 times. And sometimes I would go through Chicago. And so when you say Illinois is next to Iowa, I remember like you Minnesota know. Was north of us. I came in and out of Minneapolis sometimes. So there were times when we would do campaign events in Chicago because it seemed proximate. And I also had these visions that maybe we could get enough people in Illinois excited to volunteer to come over to Iowa and canvass.
Yes.
So what did the Joe Walsh campaign look like operationally? Were you in Illinois fundraising and you'd come back to Iowa? Were you in DC a lot? Like, did you crisscross all over? Were there pockets of Joe Walsh support in New York and California?
Yes, we actually did wind up spending we spent most of our time in Iowa. And we did not spend very much time in New Hampshire, in part because we had to work with the Weld team, right? Bill Weld is from Massachusetts, easy for him to go up to New Hampshire, and super under-resourced campaigns there almost started to be like a division of labor, right? Like, you go keep the voices loud and cultivate people in New Hampshire, and we will focus on Iowa. And both campaigns did go to both places, but we had this idea. We weren't like directly planning this, but it was obvious.
It just makes sense. You're from the neighboring states and it's like easier. Yeah.
Right. So we did spend a lot of time in places like LA, New York, and DC. And the reason that we did that is that one thing, even as fundraising was very hard, it was very challenging. And another thing that was happening at this time is that the Republican Party began canceling primaries. So,
they
literally canceled the primaries. So at some point, you start in a kamikaze campaign like that. It's like, okay, well, here's the path. And I told Joe the whole time, I said, when I took him on, I said, this is a very long shot campaign. We know what we're doing here, but I need you to look me in the eye and say that you're prepared to be president. You have to be running to be president. This can't be, we know the reality here. And so we would talk about that path, right? It's important to talk that way. And at some point, we stopped having a path because there were literally so many primaries canceled. And this is not like Joe Walsh's vermin supreme, right? Like, Bill Weld and Joe Walsh are former Republican elected officials. I mean, Bill Weld is one of the most beloved former governors. And so it was unheard of, completely crazy. But so we stopped having a path. But so that in it, we became this cycle where fundraising was so much harder. Everything was so much harder. It's like, what am I supporting here? But we spent a lot of time in New York and DC because the one thing that I had in Joe Walsh as a candidate was an amazing stage presence and an amazing ability to go on TV and rile people up in a good way. And so, you know, the reason we did something like launch on a Sunday show and continue to prioritize doing tons of media was not because Joe didn't want to be out talking to the people. He loves that. And he's actually a person who could spend, you know, 5 hours in like a, you know, like a feed store and actually hates being at a fundraising event, right? Like, actually hates being with the chattering class. But I knew that that was the way that we were going to get into people's veins, was by just sort of hitting the media machine over and over and over and over again.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit. Not to your benefit. generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang. So the fact that the Republican Party did start canceling primaries, I do remember that. I actually have a belief that we may see something similar in the Democratic Party this cycle, where if Joe runs as an incumbent and he has a challenger, let's say Marianne Williamson, that the Democratic Party wants absolutely nothing to do with, that they'll just be like, you know what, let's skip it. I think there's a real chance of that personally, because everyone knows that Jimmy Carter had a very significant primary challenge and then lost in the general. And so there's like, well, also a lot of people compare Joe Biden to Jimmy Carter for a number of reasons, but there's going to be a lot of pressure for the Democrats to avoid any kind of competitive primary.
Well, there's you and I have talked about this before and you've put it well, but it's true that I hate both sidesism about the two parties, because it's just not true. I mean, one party is being taken over by fascists and the other party is not meeting the moment, right? That's part of why the work of the Forward Party is so important. But you know, saying we need a new way doesn't mean that I think that, you know, like
the
Joe
two
Biden
current
is
parties
equivalent
are the same.
From,
yeah,
at all.
Totally.
Not at all. Not
yeah,
at all.
Totally.
But I do think that you put this, I heard you say this a couple of weeks ago and you put it really well. It expresses the same idea, which is that when one party is taking us down the long slide to authoritarianism, both parties become vulnerable. And I was at in a briefing a couple of days ago by a person who's worked all over the world trying to help stabilize democracies for years. And he said, you know, one of the big challenges is, for example, in a scenario where Trump won. This is a worst case scenario, right? Like you have a Trump Biden matchup again, and Trump wins. And you know that Trump himself is a person who may never give up power. He may do everything in his power to, you know, take control of the military, do things that are, that's the end. That's the end for us. Then you could be a pro-democracy, like want nothing more than to have free and fair elections Democrat. And you could start to feel like Joe Biden shouldn't participate in the peaceful transfer of power, because then Joe Biden is handing over the keys to this fascist, right? And so you can start to see how good people can start to take part in things that are anti-democratic, like canceling primaries, right? That it is all in the service at that moment of what feels like in service of the long game that is preserving our American democracy, but that in fact is actually very dangerous, because you then, in order to meet the moment of fighting back against authoritarianism, you have to start making compromises and doing things yourself that make you a complicit in that work. And that's why something like Forward is so important, because right now those are our only levers. That's our choice. Yeah. Those are really bad options.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. One thing I find consistently frustrating is people are like, you know, the both sidesism, the like, oh, you know, like, why are you lumping these two parties together? And it's like, look, of course, I think most people think that what's going on with the parties are very, very different. I mean, the Republican Party is to me now an authoritarian cult, and it's something that's going to persist well past Trump, in my opinion. I feel like there are now at this point a half dozen heirs to Trumpism that are channeling a lot of like the same.
They're worse.
Yeah, they may even be worse, because in some cases their competence level might be a little higher. And then on the other side, I mean, if I had to characterize the Democrats, you know, it's like an unaccountable, tone deaf bureaucracy that is condescending and preachy and willing to and it's also overrun by corporate interests of its own, because in a two-party system, it's pretty easy for a company just to be like, you know what, I'm just going to give to both of you, and like let's just keep you keep everyone off my back.
Yeah, you and I were on a phone call a couple of weeks ago with a well-known Democrat, and it was an off-the-record conversation, so I'm not going to share the person's name, but I'm mentioning that because I don't want to claim authorship of this statement. But he said something that has stuck with me, that. And this is a person who wants Democrats to win, would like to see the Democratic Party be successful, is a person who's, I think, a politically moderate person, but is very open, right? And he said, Republicans are insurrectionists and Democrats are aliens. And that has really stuck with me. I think about it every day. It's sort of, it's reductionist, but it's kind of sums up the thing, right? It's kind of the whole thing.
You know, a technologist made a similar statement to me, Lucy. He said, Republicans' programming is closer to people's base programming. Whereas, like, yes. Democratic programming requires a lot of explanation.
Yes. Yeah.
And hence the alien comment. And so we do need something like Forward to be the modernizing force to make our democracy actually a true democracy and more resilient and sustainable. Like, I don't regard the two parties as the same, but I regard the system as doomed to fail. So you're toiling with Joe, hopscotching across the country. You assign your husband to staff him for caucus night.
Yeah.
What are your fondest and darkest recollections of those 6 months or so?
Yeah, some of my darkest recollections are having had some narrow hope that more people would help me. And I had a huge, huge network on the Republican side. That's the world I'd come from. And I'd had a lot of Republican clients. And in fact, some of them had left the RNC at that point. And so I started to call them to just talk practically about whether or not they would help. And I was met with a lot of, so glad you're doing this, but I can't be a part of it. And at one point...
Profiles in courage.
Exactly. At one point, I was on the phone with someone whom I've known, like, since I was 17. We went to school together. And he is a bachelor. And I had just had dinner with him. My husband and I had dinner with him a few weeks before. And it's like, so unfettered, and was like... talking to me about, you know, his travels to, he's a Republican consultant, you know, how he was taking these fabulous trips and he just bought a new Audi. And so I call him a few weeks later to say, hey, man, I'm doing this crazy thing. You're super smart and you've worked for all the Republicans who don't even exist in this party anymore. And you have some tools and tactics and in your quiver that I could really use. And can you help me? And we'll pay you, of course, or if you don't want to do that, you should be an advisor. And I just had dinner with this person a few weeks before. He's a very, very old friend. And he said to me, you know, I'd love to, but the thing is, people have all these considerations. Like, people have kids and they have a mortgage. And I thought, okay, but you don't.
You don't.
You have an Audi. So that was one of the most disappointing things. And the feeling of that it was really invasion of the body snatchers. I mean, just awful. Much more so. I mean, that had happened in 2016 and I'd already seen that. But it is so much. I really think it's hard to remember how much worse it gets all the time. And how in the year 2019, we thought maybe there could be, I mean, people like me thought this, that like maybe the Republican Party could still be rescued. And so that's some of my darkest memories.
Sure.
Some of my fondest memories is that the relationships that I've formed since then with people who were former Republicans, so-called never Trumpers, are really, really meaningful relationships and a real sense of kind of like, well, we're all the boat has capsized and we're on, so we might as well be ourselves. It's very freeing, actually. And I really love those people. And the fact that this work has caused me in subsequent years to really form some deep professional relationships and collaborative dynamics with Democrats who are actually much more aligned with me than we might have ever thought. That's really wonderful. I really love the people that I'm in this fight with and feel happy. I like being around them. They make me feel good. It's stimulating. It's exciting. It's forward thinking. I love that.
Yeah, I love it too. And that brings us to our work with Forward.
Yeah.
So first, kudos to you for stepping up to try and avert Trump's return, for being courageous and principled, genuinely patriotic, doing something that's in the nation's interest, that's not narrowly in one's own self-interest. I mean, like you have legions of people who've made a very different decision. And on one level, you don't blame them. But on another, you're just like, hey, guys, character, you know, like genuine independence, courage, you want to do something you might actually feel good about later. So kudos to you for doing the difficult thing. And I agree with you that when you do the difficult, noble thing, you wind up making common cause with people that you're bonded with for life. And you've stayed in the fight even after the 2020 race. So the three organizations that have now merged to form the new Forward Party, Renew America and Serve America, you were involved with Renew.
I was not ever involved with Renew in a staff capacity, but I took part in a lot of their early conversations. That's the world I come from, right? The world of disaffected Republicans and conservatives and independents who had hoped that there could be a different lane. I think one of the things they ran into is that it's sort of like the boat is capsized, so now we might as well be ourselves. That group didn't naturally form a clear constituency. You know, the idea of we were bonded before because we were Republicans, but we were all making these concessions to other people on their issues, right? So if you then try to bring together people who may separately be kind of dogmatic on a handful of issues, like you have the neocons in the room, then maybe you have the social conservatives, and then you have like the taxationist theft people. And because it's not the case that all Never Trumpers are people who were like squishy moderate Republicans. That's just not true. I mean, some of them are culture warriors, right? And so, you know, I think that group, Renew, one of the things they found, and I'm saying this as an outsider who I wasn't running the organization, but is that there was less natural alignment, right? They were aligned on something very important, but if the work was to then go reform the Republican Party, they all had to be thinking, do I even want to reform the Republican Party? Is that even the thing that I want to be a part of? And we're all untethered by our former bonds to the Republican Party. But so I think I was delighted when I, you know, got together with my friend Miles Taylor and he said, we're going to do this crazy thing. I thought, great. How can I help you do that?
Yeah. Miles said that early on, they had a meeting where they said, hey guys, do you think we should try and reform the Republican Party or just form a new party? And it was 50-50. And they said, okay, I guess we'll try and reform the Republican Party and see if that works. And now people have concluded that it's not working. And by the way, newsflash, it's not working. At this point you have, seven out of 10 of the Republicans who voted to impeach Trump who are out or going to be out soon. Liz Cheney's probably going to lose pretty soon. And Liz, we want to talk to you about joining Forward. That will shock absolutely nobody. Trump's hold of the party just gets stronger. The latest FBI raid news has only strengthened that dynamic, where there are a number of Republicans who are looking at taking him on in the presidential, who I think just saw their hopes dim, frankly. And some of them are still looking for a way to be of service and to run. One of the things you all ran into, and this is one of the big cases Forward is making, is like, look, there are a lot of people that would choose someone other than Trump, even within the Republican Party. They just might not vote in a Republican primary, where if you look at the 5 to 10% of voters who are party activists, like that's a very, very different version of the public than, let's say, you know, 100% of the voting population. So there are a bunch of moderate Republican types or independent types who I think are looking to run for president, but don't think the Republican primary is the way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the challenges for the Republican Party is that only a third of Republican voters, mostly when polled, think that Joe Biden won the election. And so that means functionally that to get through a Republican primary, you have to be a person who's willing to participate in the big lie. And that also has is a reflection of the fact that people who live, who don't take part in that horrible part of that has become the dominant culture in the Republican Party are leaving the Republican Party. I grew up in Arizona, and this isn't just happening at the top of the ticket. And I mean, I think part of what's so powerful about Forward is that we're saying there are 500,000 elected offices, right? And there are mayor's races and there are state legislative races and city council races and governor, a lot of races beyond the presidency, a lot of races beyond the Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. I grew up in Arizona, and people who are followers of election results know that last week in Arizona, my home state, was an absolute bloodbath. Every Republican endorsed by Trump won. The top of the ticket, the gubernatorial candidate, Carrie Lake, is literally talking about how Arizona should secede from the union. Mark Fincham, the presumptive, the Republican nominee for Secretary of State, is a member of the Oath Keepers and was there on January 6th, was part of the group that stormed the Capitol. The state lawmakers, including people like Rusty Bowers, who was the former Speaker of the House in Arizona, who actually had the courage to testify in the January 6th hearings. He stood the line, held the line. He was defeated. Every Republican who's ever said a bad word about Trump, other than some people running at the county level, they were blown out. And so people look at a state like Arizona and they say, wait, we thought we were into Arizona. We thought Arizona was like this cool kind of purple turning blue state. What's happening? And the answer is, it is that state. It actually is. But our system is so screwed up that now you have these a really hardened base choosing the Republican candidates. And then we're all just forced to choose between the Republican candidates and the Democratic candidates, who have their own issues because they're also turning people out at the polls, polls as in the extremes, P-O-L-E-S. And so, yeah, you could wind up in a state that was heroic in the eyes of people who care about democracy last year in 2020, right? And it's the same people living, it's the same good people living in that state. It hasn't changed. It's probably, if anything, it's gotten more liberal, but that's the problem, right? That is like a, that's like a case study for why we need different and more levers in this system.
Yeah, that is dark. It's true. The Trumpian takeover of the Republican Party of Arizona, and you're seeing similar types of candidates prevail all over the place. One of the themes of the last couple of weeks was that occasionally Democrats have boosted them, like the way they boosted Peter Meyer's opponent. Because they said, hey, this extremist will be more beatable in the general. So what if they're an election denier? So what if they're like a threat to democracy? Let's spend $1 million and like get them into the general. So you and I have been in a bunch of meetings with the Forward Party. What have you been seeing and hearing? I actually, you know, would love to hear this in real time because, you know, I don't know the latest.
Yeah, I think that one thing that I'm seeing and hearing is that people are really excited about some of the structural commitments that the Forward Party is making. I think that it really resonates with people that we're making commitments about outcomes and not prescribing the tactics, right? You know, in our current policy landscape, it becomes a fight between one party's proposed tactic and another, and the outcomes, like, you name it, right? Having healthy communities, having access to clean air, you know, being able to have a context that gives way to successful entrepreneurship, being able to start a business, being able to care for your young kids, being able to make sure that they're getting a high quality education. There's not a commitment to those outcomes. There's a fight about which tactic we should use. And then no one comes out of that thinking like, gosh, we just spent another legislative session fighting. We actually have not achieved any of those means. And so I think it's resonating with people, not the pundit class, but it's resonating with people that commitments about helping to empower people to choose what kind of communities they live in, what kind of solutions work for them, and working together, I think is really powerful. I was on the phone with a couple of days ago with people who work in the bridging community, you know, who work to bridge left and right, help to work on things like deliberative democracy. And they said to me, and this was it was kind of like a meet and greet phone call. And they said, they began by saying after intros, Lucy, what can we do to help the Forward Party? And I said, I'm not skirting your question, but what I actually want to talk about is what can the Forward Party do to help you? How can we help your work? Because the party, any political party, should be a means to an end. It should be meaningful enough to have influence, but it actually should be as small and empty a vessel as possible, because it's a tool by which to make people's lives better, make our communities the communities we want to live in. And they were taken aback by that. But I think that is something people are taken aback about. But then when they think about it, they're like, oh, yes, in our current party system, not just the two major parties, third parties, all the parties, they're just about power. So ultimately, pretty quickly, the parties become this thing where what is first is, are we in power? And the people that matter get lost. And I think another thing that people really like about the Forward Party that I hope becomes part of our cultural DNA is, you know how people will say these things, people like you and people like us, like no one says this to us because they're just like, they're crazy people. But you know, the idea that you shouldn't talk about religion or politics, you know, like with a person that you meet, a stranger. And that doesn't work for people who spend their lives doing it. Someone's like, what do you do for a living? So we're having a conversation about politics at that point.
No, Lucy, I mean, it's 1 degree worse for me because people know you and then they'll talk about politics immediately.
They see you. No, I've traveled with you now. So I know, like walking through an airport, someone, a stranger, you know, we're like, where's the car rental place? Like we're talking about, actually now we're talking about politics. But why shouldn't we be talking about politics? Politics drives so much of our lives. And the reason that we can't talk about politics is that we don't trust each other or trust ourselves to be able to talk about politics in a way that isn't really tribal and dysfunctional. So part of the commitment that the Forward Party is making is that we could have disagreements. Like you could characterize something in a way that I disagree with, and we could talk about it. We could talk about it on a podcast. We could talk about it right here. We could talk about it on a stage. And it wouldn't mean that we've become mortal enemies, right? It would mean that reasonable minds can disagree and that we might disagree on how to get to an outcome.
I'm very, very sensitive though, Lucy. I don't know if you disagree with me, you know,
well, I know.
I might.
I know, Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, that is the best thing
people
about the Ford
are excited
Party. It's
about
really.
That.
Yeah, no, it's very much come as you are, you know,
yeah.
And when I spoke to a conservative Republican in West Virginia on a Zoom, he was like, oh,
Joe
Mr.
Manchin,
Yang. I don't think
conservative Republican, it wasn't, Joe Manchin, no, I'm just kidding.
Someone even better than Joe. So yeah. He said, Mr. Yang, I don't think I can join your party because I'm a conservative coal miner Republican here in West Virginia. And I said, look, we can disagree on all sorts of things as long as you agree the two-party system's not working and that the Republican Party is not actually exactly, you know, solving the problems you're seeing around you, then we'd love to have you in Forward. And literally 45 seconds later, he was like, all right, I'm in.
It
made me feel so good. A lot of Americans don't think that one party wants them because we might disagree on something. And Forward's very much the opposite. It's like, well, we want you. We don't care if you agree or disagree. I think someone said, we're not going to check your ID at the door. Another thing about Forward too, that's kind of funny, is people say like, hey, can I keep my party registration? And then we're like, well, right now you technically can't even register with Ford in your state, probably.
Sure. Right.
Like, I mean, we're going to get there. Like, you know, eventually we'll have ballot access in various places.
Yeah.
15 states by the end of this year. But in the interim, I mean, we're building a broad, popular, inclusive movement, and we need people to join. And I think that that's like that's a different message than the parties right now. The parties seem like they're just like throwing up various litmus tests and gates in a particular way. And a lot of it's a call to action being like, hey, you know, what unifies us is like, we can't stand those people.
Yeah.
And we're like, look, you know, we understand there are problems, but, you know, we love other people.
Totally. I think the come as you are thing that's a really good way to describe it. And both parties do this, but I've spent several years trying to help Democrats get people elected, to get Democrats elected. And it's a little bit like headbanging against the wall all the time, because I've also seen the way that they'll have someone just who's like trying to join them, right? Maybe like a suburban mom who usually votes Republican, but really cares about preserving choice. Like really just is activated by the idea that, you know, she wants to make sure that there's access to safe and legal abortion in her state. And she doesn't want to see a heartbeat bill. And she wants to make sure there's access to birth control. I've watched over and over again in individual interactions and at scale, just I'm deliberately choosing a controversial issue to make the point. I've watched Democrats do things like, okay, here's this woman. Look, she's going to be in your column. She's going to only vote for Democrats this year because she so cares about this issue. And instead of being like, great, we're so glad you're here.
Great.
They're like, okay, you are now in the engagement funnel where you must make a lot of commitments about why and how your view came to be. And you must agree that all Republicans are trying to control women. That is what they're trying to do. It's not just the downstream effect. That's what they're trying to do. And you also must agree now that you will never support any limit on abortion. Like you want, you know, and it's like, that's not how people feel. Like no one feels that way. Right. And so then suddenly it's like, oh gosh, I actually don't want to be with those people. So that dogmatic attitude where you can't be a supporter, like you're not even allowed to be a supporter unless you make a whole bunch of signals. That is a thing that people are for sure sick of, like exhausted of. And you're going to see that showing up, I think, in a lot of local races, state legislative races, gubernatorial races, where there are some candidates doing that already. That's happening in Oregon. There's an independent candidate in Oregon running for governor who is polling even with the Democrat, right? She may win, right? Oregon. So
yes,
there's a
Betsy
for
Johnson.
This, for sure.
I met with Betsy last month. Feel free to check out Betsy Johnson. I'm supporting Betsy, so I obviously am excited about that. But have you met Betsy? She's great.
I haven't, but some really fabulous people who are campaign operatives that I've done a lot of work with over the years who come from my sort of background are working with her. So I hear a lot about stories from their trail.
Yeah, it is fun having leaders like you try and help people like Betsy and Evan McMullen and Bill Walker and Clint Smith these other independents. And it does irk me somewhat to your earlier point that like people are all obsessed about the presidential. It's like, look, there's a ton of stuff we can do right now that's going to have a lot of impact in various communities. And it's just so like it does piss me off that the press just resorts to like this laziness because it suits their ends. I mean, their ends are like, look, I just want to keep you in that corner. And, you know, you hate him. You hate them. Send us money. Click on our stuff. Oh, wait, third party. Wait, that might interrupt our narrative. Like, no, bad, bad.
You know, like, I did an interview the other day. It was a local news interview. I think it was in the Bay Area. Super nice reporter anchor, but it was not like a political show. Right. And she wanted to ask, she immediately went to the 2024 presidential because that's where people's minds go. And of course, the involvement of people like you in this as someone who's a founder and a leader in this, that makes their minds go to that. And so we talked about that and I covered why. And I said, but, you know, there are 500,000 races. I was saying a lot of the things we've said on this podcast. And then she said, okay, well, I want to ask you a follow-up question. Some people are saying that they are worried that the Forward Party will take votes from the other two parties. And I would like to know how you'd respond to that. And I said, yes, that's our plan. We are going to do that. We're a political party. We are absolutely going to take votes. But it's like you're seeing in real time. I then said to her, and you're seeing this in real time, like, oh, everyone's in an abusive relationship with the two-party
system.
That
is the parallel. That is the parallel for sure.
It's like this idea of like, well, I talked to a Democratic operative who said that they're worried that the Forward Party could siphon Democratic votes in, you know, XYZ little race in, you know, XYZ place. It's like, well, you know what? Then that Democrat should work to make their message more palatable to the voters. Competition is good. It's good for people to have choices. We agree about that in every area of our lives. That's so fundamentally American. And the thing that turns out to be arguably the most deterministic about what our communities and societies look like, that is voting and who represents us and how do we elect our leaders, in and of itself ends up being by accident completely anti-American. So it's interesting to watch people kind of challenge their own programming that they didn't even know was inside of them. I really love that.
Yeah, the parallel truly is an abusive relationship. Where I was joking with someone, it's like the primary defense of the two-party system is to point out how dysfunctional it is. You know what I mean? They'd be like, I mean, it's strange.
It is weird.
But it's fun making it more American alongside you. If someone wants to follow you, Lucy, how do they do so?
Well, if they'd like to follow me on Twitter, they can do that at Lucy M. Caldwell.
Fantastic. Excited to build this party alongside you. And thanks again for standing up for what's right in the face of a lot of pressure and I'm sure adversity. We owe you a great deal, and we are just getting started.
Likewise, Andrew. Thank you so much. This has been fun.